This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Howdy, hi, Matt McNeil, not in studio. It's another one of our brand new to you shows we do over the holidays. Thank you very much for being with us. And once again, I hope you're having a wonderful holiday season, no matter where you are and where who you're with. So thank you very much. Once again, we do brand new shows throughout the holidays so that you can enjoy brand new content here in the Matt McNeil Show. And today, we're going to be joined by the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum, John Crippen. If you haven't been paying attention, it's obviously a pandemic going on in this country. But museums have been put into a very unique situation, and museums of all types, whether that's natural history museums, art museums, museums were as caught off guard by this as anything else. And because of the nature of what museums do, it became very difficult to have people come into galleries, especially when we had full shutdowns and lockdowns. And so I wanted to bring on someone who is extremely knowledgeable, John Crippen. You might recognize as someone we've had on the air in the past. He was working for various other historical organizations, and once again now with the Hennepin History Museum. He's kind enough today to talk a little bit about how the pandemic has affected museums and how we can help museums get through into 2021 and beyond as we all go through this crisis. John, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Oh, thank you, Matt. It's great to be with you again.
Good to have you with us. You've been, I should mention, I think this is the first time we've talked since you moved over to the Hennepin History Museum. Congratulations on that transfer.
Yeah, thanks. It's been a lot of fun. I've been here about a year, and it's not the year I envisioned, obviously, but it's been an adventure, that's for sure.
All right. I'm going to ask a question where, once again, it's purely hypothetical. How many museums and organizations, nonprofits of that nature, do you think had, prior to this year, a working game plan for operations during a pandemic? Any off the top of your head that you came that said, oh, yeah, they were ready for something like this?
How about zero, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's just not something that we knew how to plan for, frankly. Speaking mostly for myself, but just I think talking with others as well. Certainly, we've heard over the years epidemiologists saying there might be pandemics, and when the swine flu and the H1N1 came a few years ago, people kind of got worried, but this had never really hit us for 100 years, not since the 1918 Spanish flu outbreak has the country been, and the world, frankly, been in the grips of something like this. So it's definitely a whole new thing that nobody's had to figure out before. Stunning to me was how fast the dominoes fell. Mm-hmm. We'd been watching it January and February and starting to wonder if we should close. And within 3 days, it seemed like everybody was independently making their decision, and then the governor confirmed what we all had already said we needed to do and shut us all down. But it swept in with its own weird momentum.
And it's kind of like, I like how you described it. Can we have an earthquake in Minneapolis? Sure. I guarantee there's a fault line down there somewhere that could shake the city. But does anyone plan for it? Not really. And I think...
eventually we do. I mean, this is, an interesting question, too. So on the West Coast, they do plan for earthquakes now. They build buildings that can withstand those. And it'll be really interesting to see, coming out of this, because we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, they say, how much will we keep plans in place now, and how much will we... I expect that we will, and I expect that since this isn't the end of viruses in this increasingly interconnected world, I expect that people are going to keep contingency plans from now on. On the other hand, it's hard to contingency plan. As you suggested in your intro, museums are defined by people coming together in a place. And so it's really hard to pivot on that and take away kind of that fundamental thing. So as I look to the future, I don't think the digital stuff that we've been doing is ever going to go away completely, but I know that my gut tells me there's going to be a backlash too, and people, once they feel safe, are just going to be desperate to get together in a more normal human way. So what the contingency plans look like, I don't know if anybody knows yet, but you're going to have them.
I agree with you wholeheartedly that I think that this when we get this all over, I think people are heading out. We'll get to that in a little bit. You're a relatively new executive director at the Hennepin History Museum. I'm presuming you had exhibits, you had a game plan in place when this year started. That's hard because one of the things we all know, I mean, I don't care if it's your museum, the MIA, even the Science Museum, that the museums, when you're planning out exhibits, this is not a, you know, we're going to do this next week. Let's go get a cow and a curtain. We'll put on a show. You know, it's
right. This yeah, is our exhibit project. Plan just went out the window. Yeah. We had to scrap and reshape. We were planning to do an exhibit to follow up on our current Votes for Women exhibit that was focused on a local artist and working with a guy who's been researching her. And he fell ill, not from COVID, as it turned out, but he had his own health problems. And so that was our first sign of, we got to start figuring out new things. But yeah, it's, for Hennepin History Museum, I think the biggest curveball for us was, I was new coming on. We've had a couple other new staff members, and we just kind of got cut off at the knees from the work that we expected to do in our first year, which was meeting new people, expanding the reach of the museum. Your listeners will be forgiven if they've not heard of the Hennepin History Museum or if they're only vaguely aware of it, because it's been a pretty quiet organization just a block away from MIA. And our big plans for 2020 were to stop being so quiet about it and to start building new friends and new bases of support. And we just had to really recalibrate how fast we do that and how we do that, frankly.
There is always, when this began, I imagine there was a lot of questions on, okay, do we scrap an exhibit as we had planned it and try to do a virtual version of it? Or do we just hope that things open up here in a little bit? I'm talk a little bit about that initial, as you talked with the experts, you talk about the exhibitors and the historians, and as you're trying to get this together, I mean, there's a lot of people that have got, that have a lot of time invested in the process. How easy was it to start reevaluating that, realizing that, okay, we might not be able to do this in any shape or form that we anticipated when we started this process?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. Because there are so many variables embedded in it. On the one hand, one of the great advantages of a place like Hennepin History Museum and our size, we've got 9 staff, we can pivot pretty quickly and we can try new things pretty quickly. So in the depths of the stay-at-home order, I was talking with Alyssa Seedy, our curator, and she'd been racking her brains. Okay, how do we replace this exhibit that just fell apart about the artist? And she was looking through the collection, and she was reminding herself that a strength of our collection is medical professionals, especially from previous eras. Mm-hmm. And so she said, well, in the age of COVID, maybe we should do an exhibit honoring medical professionals in Hennepin County. So that's what she's been working on. So that's great. Mm-hmm. Great idea, great connection and resonance with what's going on now.
Absolutely.
But exhibits take research. Research takes libraries, and she couldn't get access to any libraries to do research outside of our own. So she's pulling it together, doing an amazing job, but she's really struggled through the process of it because of the lack of access to things. And then your question about building the exhibit and what are your contingency plans. We had this problem anyway because we've got accessibility issues with our building in terms of stairs and lack of elevators and what have you. So we've got a current mantra that every physical exhibit we build, we have to have a digital component so that people who can't make it into the building have another way to access that engage with that information and that story. So on the one hand, we're going to do that anyway. Now we really have to do it because, no, we've got Local Heroes opening February 4th, but what does opening on February 4th mean? We don't know yet if the world will feel like a safer place by then, or if we'll still be on stay-at-home orders. So there will be something happening on February 4th or thereabouts. It may just be digital. We'll have to see.
It's interesting because, I mean, obviously I know you guys want a new museum and I know you want better accessibility. But in hindsight, because your mission was geared around both an in-person and a digital program, I imagine the Hennepin History Museum did better than other museums when it came to having to make this transition.
Yeah, in some ways. We're certainly envious of our bigger brothers and sisters around town who've got dedicated staff that do digital content every day. So our capacity is somewhat limited in that realm, and we can't do some of the really cooler things. On the other hand, our overhead was lower, our reliance on gate was lower, so nobody's coming out of this smelling like a rose. We all have our challenges. They're just kind of different variations on the theme. So I don't have the depth of power of staff that some of the bigger museums have that can really do whiz-bang digital content. Ours is pretty rudimentary, to be honest. On the other hand, I've got a small number of generalists who can be reassigned to other things during this pandemic. So we've had no layoffs through this whole process. Which is remarkable because we've had small overhead and not a huge reliance on admissions and sales, whereas the big museums in town are hurting really badly because they rely on people coming through the door every day and have a lot of staff that serve those people, and they're all suffering. So everybody's got their own tale of woe, I think.
Well, tell you what, we're going to come back. We'll talk about staffing issues and how that has that played in with you. Once again, and joining us right now is the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum, John Crippen. We're talking about museums in the age of the pandemic and how you can help out museums. Because once again, museums, they've been hit just as hard as everyone else has. We'll talk about how you can help out as well. Let's take a break. Come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.
We're breaking out this time.
AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Once again, a brand new to you show. Matt McNeil on vacation, not here, but bringing you John Crippen, the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum, as we are talking about museums in the age of the pandemic. Basically making sure I let everyone know, I'm on the board of the Hennepin History Museum. This is why I brought John on, because I know John. I know the museum as well. John, if we can take a little moment here, let's talk about the Hennepin History Museum, because I think earlier you'd mentioned there might be a lot of people that might not be aware that Hennepin County itself has its own museum recognizing the history of Hennepin County.
That's right. And we were founded in 1938 as the Hennepin County Historical Society. So a lot of people might be more familiar with that terminology because every county in the state has its own historical society. We serve that function for Hennepin County. The organization decided 20, 30 years ago to change the name to Hennepin History Museum as just kind of a cleaner, more modern sound to the organization. But we have a museum with exhibit galleries, but we also have a library, as you would expect from a historical society. So a key part of our serving the public is being able to facilitate that research function for local history. And then the kind of third leg of the stool is we've got a magazine that we've been publishing continuously since 1941. And that comes out three times a year. And that's been another savior for us in 2020 because it's the most COVID-proof program we've got. The magazine continued without a hitch because it's already being sent to people's homes, and that's how people expect it. So that's been a nice little thing of stability in this whole crazy mess.
I want to encourage everyone, go hennepinhistory.org, hennepinhistory.org, about more information about the Hennepin History Museum. I like the concept of the Hennepin History Museum because as a person who has grown up a good portion of my life and spent a good portion of my life in Hennepin County, you have the diversity, the eclectic nature of the city. You have a truly diverse, you know, rural part. I mean, you've got, you know, farm communities still today that are in Hennepin County, as well as growing and thriving suburbs. You have, you know, the history of from the Native American populations into the early settlers as the city has grown. There's so much here. I mean, I know it's for you that you've worked with on the state level on history before. Is it fun for you and the museum to be able to look and look at the whole of Hennepin County and realize what a kind of a treasure trove you have as far as history goes?
Absolutely, it's great to be able to focus on that. As you remember, Matt, I worked with the State Historic Site System for many, many years, and what I loved about working with the historic sites was getting into the communities around the state and doing that local version of a statewide story. To me, that's what really resonates with people and helps them understand how their world, their local world, their local community was created and formed. So that's what gets me excited, is that connection that we can make with people. And Hennepin County is a fascinating entity as a county, as a it's the biggest county in the state by far by population, and as you suggest, just the development patterns and the communities in the county have changed so much in the last 100 years, but are so diverse in terms of what the flavor and feel of it is, because you can start on the eastern edge of the county, which is the biggest city in the state, and on the western edge of the county, you still have farms. So, and then you've got this huge, interesting, rich mix of suburbs in between.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, and it's one of the things that's nice too, is that this idea that we can talk about the county's history as a whole, because I like going like the bike trails, and you know I do that. I'll go out and bike, mm-hmm. and you can. I love, like, I'll take the line. You can go from right on the west side of Minneapolis, right just north of Cedar Lake, and you are taking an old line that used to go there, that people used to travel on, and you used to go down this way. And you can see as the city unfolded, that's, I think, the most important part, is because I think there is this I don't want to – I think history kind of gets lost sometimes on the development of suburbia and how cities grow. It's not just – it just doesn't happen, and it happens generally in a unique way. And I think that that's one of the things that's nice, is when you bring in like a Hennepin History Museum, you can start with the city and then see how it grows out, and you can see how the history itself has changed. I mean, I was biking out on, like I said, that bike trail. There's a fence line there that's probably the old farmer's fence, that when that was a farm that was there. And here it is. It's, you know, right in the heart of downtown. I got the skyline right next to me. There's 394 right there. And the history is right there to be seen. And so I think it's a wonderful template to be working with.
Yeah, and it's a huge opportunity for us and a challenge for us to figure out how to continue to take advantage of the whole county and explore the history of the whole county. We're blessed with a rich array of city-level historical societies, as you know. Many of the cities in Hennepin County have their own historical societies. And I think that reflected a little bit. When I first came on a year or so ago, we were talking, we're doing a strategy session with the board and talking about what is the identity of Hennepin County. And the identity of Hennepin County is a little slippery. If you think about when you introduce yourself to folks and people ask you where you're from, you're likely to either say you're from Minnesota or you're from the city that you live in. You're not likely to say, I'm from Hennepin County. It's a little different than if you're out in a rural area where you might say, yeah, I'm from Nobles County or Cottonwood County or what have you. So the city identity is, I think, stronger, municipality by municipality. But what is it that knits us together, and what is it about this as an entity that we can explore in more depth? That's kind of what I think is an exciting challenge over the next few years.
And as well, when you talk about this year, not only do we have obviously the impact of the pandemic, I mean, as a historical organization, what happened with George Floyd in the aftermath, you are watching something. I mean, there's obviously a part of your historical background, your pedigree, that is watching this unfold as it happens and realizing we're going to be talking about this for hundreds of years. We better make sure we're there on the front line and trying to keep track of as much of it as possible, because, I mean, that's the thing about history. It never ends. It's always continuing every single day.
Absolutely. And that tragic event just crystallized for us what we already knew, but it just spurred us on to more intense focus of these are the kind of things that people want to know about. They want to understand, how did we get here? As I said at the time, we had already known that by far and away the most resonating program of this organization's last 5 years was an exhibit we did with as a capstone project with a student at the Heritage Studies Public History Program at the U of M. And that exhibit was called Owning Up, and it was putting in exhibit form the story that thankfully a lot more people know about now of the actual policies that shaped the way neighborhoods around the city of Minneapolis were formed. So people really resonated with that because it actually helped them understand how the world they lived in came to be the way it was and realized this wasn't an accident. This was an intentional policy directive from people 80, 100 years ago. The killing of George Floyd just intensified people's interest in, okay, how did we get here? Lots of people vaguely knew that this was a problem. Lots of people specifically knew it was a problem. But now what do we do? So, and how do we as a museum help people explore that? And we do what we do. One of the things that we knew we had, but now has increasing resonance is, we've got the papers of Charles Stenvig, who was a mayor in Minneapolis in the 1970s. And many think the kind of creator of the Minneapolis Union, police union, as we know it today. So that's suddenly a great resource for scholars to look at and say, all right, how do we figure out how we got here as a way to create what the new future people want to create is.
And understanding the future, absolutely. And once again, I want to encourage everyone, hennepinhistory.org, hennepinhistory.org, the Hennepin History Museum. Let's take another break. John Crippen, the executive director from the Hennepin History Museum, is kind enough to join us this hour. We'll talk more about the challenges of the pandemic when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Joining us right now is John Crippen, the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum. We are talking about the challenges of running a museum during these pandemic times. And earlier, John, you had brought up the size of the staff. You had mentioned yourself that this is not one of the bigger museums you're going to find. How big is the staff at the Hennepin History Museum?
We've got 9 full-time staff, or full, semi-full-time, and then we've got some part-time staff that come on when we're open and that sort of thing, but it's a pretty lean and mean group.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned you had been able to stay away so far from having to lay anyone off, which is, considering the nature of what's been going on, that's you are the exception to the rule at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, and we did that because the size of staff and nature of it is we were already, most people are doing more than one thing, and so pivot to some other things. So, for example, our visitor services manager was also our communications manager, and so we just said she's going to switch full-time over to doing some communications work, getting the word out about various initiatives we do, and fill in while we were waiting for a development person to come on board. And so she was keeping the fundraising activities together. Our public programs manager was dabbling on the side in social media just to promote the programs. But when public programs fell apart in person, we'd been talking for some time that we needed to up our game on social media. So Sophie kind of went all in and figured out how can we activate that a little bit. And at the same time, she had to figure out how can we do online programming in a whole new way. So there was plenty of stuff to do, that's for sure.
I know people, and I'm not going to say with the museums that they're at. I know people who are at museums where they are a large staff, and they have been part. They're still employed, and they're grateful for that. But because of the nature of what's happened with the layoffs that have happened, the first thing they say is that I'm now doing the job of three people. It's not really been streamlined, and it's difficult. And you can see the tension building there. And I'm not saying that it's not the same. Obviously, your museum is shut down like everyone else. But I think that it is interesting. I think people would look at the size of an organization. They would immediately say, well, the big organization is going to have a better chance of weathering a pandemic or a major shutdown like this. But the reality is you're showing it's actually a smaller, more tight-knit group, more specialized in that they're within each individual departments that actually can kind of almost weather this crisis better.
Yeah. And again, it's time will tell. There are dire predictions out there of some people are saying a third of all nonprofits are not going to survive this long term. I don't know if that's the right number, and I don't know which ones are going to make it and not make it. Big organizations have a deeper well of financial strength, frankly, so that's going to help them in the long run. We're not out of the woods yet. We've got to make payroll every other week. In a pressing way that might not be as difficult as a big organization. But yeah, to your point, we are able to more quickly reorient ourselves and say, what new process can it work, because we just have a smaller group. We always talk to the Minnesota Historical Society about the cliche of trying to turn the Titanic. Mm-hmm. And turning a big ship takes time and what have you. So we're a smaller ship. We can turn a little bit faster, but we can also get smashed by a wave a lot easier too. So pick your poison, I guess.
has it been you talked about how museums have changed and with this crisis, and that there's going to be some things I think that do not go back, that this is going to change how things, you know, are on some levels. I mean, not completely, I agree with wholeheartedly. When this thing is over, people are going to want to go on out, that's for sure. But to talk about how that has, you know, forced the museum, your museum, to kind of revisit the mission, because every one of these museums has a mission. Was this an opportunity for you to revisit this and say, is this not factoring in the environment that we are in right now?
Yeah. I think the core mission of, for us, exploring history, helping people understand history's meaning in their lives, that now has a bold new area with the digital format. Where we can reach more people in interesting ways, and I think that if there's a silver lining to the pandemic, one of the silver linings is it's pushed all of us into that world and gotten us to try things that we might not have gotten around to try, or might not have, you know. Sometimes crisis can focus you and get you thinking in creative ways, but that's the core mission. The key way that museums often achieve that mission is with their objects and that visceral connection to an object. So I mentioned earlier in the hour the Votes for Women exhibit we have. That's content that can be shared online, but the star of that show is the voting machine that we have that came from the pre-19th Amendment era, when women in Minnesota could only vote for library board and school board. And it's one of those objects that museum geeks anyway just kind of go, oh, that's one of those objects. It grabs you by the throat, and the hair on my back goes up every time I get close to that thing, because it just helps you understand, or it helps you imagine anyway, I don't know if I can fully understand it, what it might have been like to walk into a voting booth and just have it thrown in your face that you can't vote for these people. You can vote for a little bit, but we're just going to give you a few crumbs on the side. That kind of an object is really hard to convey digitally.
Yeah.
And so I think there's always going to be a place for letting people get up close and personal with the real stuff. That's what museums do, is we collect and we share real stuff. But it's both. You know, it's ideas and it's things. And ideas are easier to convey digitally. Things, a little bit harder.
I completely agree with you. I remember, I'll never forget the two things I saw at the Smithsonian. I took the kids out there about a few years ago. One was the flag from Fort Henry, the one they wrote the Star Spangled Banner about. And they had it on display, and it was huge, and it was amazing. But then the other one was the chair and the tables, the chairs and the table from Appomattox, where Lee and Grant surrendered. And, you know, you're looking at this. I mean, the objects themselves, I mean, this is the one of the great things about history, is that you can see something. Sometimes you can hold it. Sometimes you can, you know, kind of look at all angles of it. It's hard when you don't have that ability. But at the same time, you know, this is temporary. You know, thankfully, this will be temporary. You know, it does kind of, I imagine for you as an organization, that's the, you know, there's that real challenge in the, you don't want it just to become facts. You don't want to be, you want it to still be something that you want to grab onto and see and look at directly. And being able to convey that in this day and age, that's the challenge.
Yeah. And one of the nice little, right down the middle of that, between the virtual and the physical, that you and I did some exploration with this fall, was the walking tour concept.
Yes.
And if one of the things I'm kicking myself about how this year played out is that we didn't figure out much earlier in the summer that walking tours might be one of those perfect COVID kind of programs, because you can see the real thing out in the world, but in a safer, socially distant way where people are willing to engage. We were, frankly, all just kind of making do. By, you know, March rocked everybody's world and we all hunkered down. And then as summer dawned, we were, well, first we had the killing of George Floyd, and that sent everybody going in a different direction in an important and necessary way. But anyway, by the end of the summer, we realized, all right, let's at least try this. And what we found was some people are willing to come out, and they can feel safe outdoors and that sort of thing. And then you can get them to see the real thing as well. And just to explain to the listeners, you and I were working on a tour of Hopkins,
yes,
which is fascinating. And as I reflect on that, we were just doing some prototyping that hopefully we can roll out in a better way in the spring. I was saying to you, okay, what is real? What can people see? And then this conversation is just making me think, and when people can't see it anymore, because that building's gone, is there stuff in the real, like you're out on the in the walk, are there some digital things that we can insert during the walk that help people imagine what this landscape used to look like? I think there might be some fun things to do in the future, because the old school way with walking tours is you've got a flip book with photos, but there's some new techniques that might be out there. So that's an interesting hybrid that we might keep working on.
And you and I learned a lesson. These walking tours are not easy to do.
No.
I learned that was difficult. We're hoping this, as you talked at the very beginning of this, hopefully this will start to wane. Talk a little bit about how your museum is prepping for the reopening, that once people vaccines are starting to get out there more, people are looking to get back open again. The governor lists some of these restrictions. How is the museum looking at reopening after the pandemic?
Well, just to remind folks, we did reopen at the end of September, as most places around town did. And even the big museums, we've been talking every couple weeks, an arts and culture group, leaders from around the Twin Cities and now the state have been talking. Day by day, the visitation flow in a museum was living within that, the governor gave us guidelines of 25% of our building capacity. And for a normal museum visiting day, you're not usually going to get over 25% of your capacity anyway. So that hadn't been a problem, and opening had been relatively smooth. We came up with procedures, and we tried to create some routes for folks. But frankly, it felt to me as we were doing the planning, not unlike a grocery store. Museum people, visitors, don't usually follow a prescribed route. They usually wander around a bit. But they linger just like you linger at a grocery store in an aisle, and then they move on. And so it wasn't too difficult to manage the safety of it, frankly. What we all realized, it was almost to a person that people were saying, yeah, we're getting about 30% of our previous visitation levels. There's 60%, 66% of the population that just doesn't want to do this kind of activity. They're just staying home. Mm-hmm. That was a struggle for everybody just to manage our expectations about what kind of flow we can have. I think the big thing, to get back to your original question, like what are we preparing for and what'll be the big shift once vaccines are widely available and people feel safe, is the bigger gatherings of folks. So having a public program where you get 50 people in a room, mm-hmm. that's what's been missing, I think, from the museum experience. The day-by-day stuff, where you've got a quiet afternoon and a few people wandering in the gallery, that can blinker back on as soon as we're allowed to do that again. It's the big gatherings that are some of the most energetic moments in a museum, and we just can't do until we get a lot further along down mm-hmm. that post-pandemic world.
And I want to make sure I step in here really quick and make sure to mention everyone. It's like we want everyone to be safe and you be with comfortable as you need to be as we hopefully are going to get to the end of this pandemic here. But when things are better, obviously the Hennepin History Museum is a place you're going to be able to stop on by and enjoy in however the capacities are as we go through here. Let's take another break here and a final break. And when we do come on back, let's talk a little bit about, supporting museums as we go through this crisis, as well as what's coming up for your museum over the next few months. John Crippen, once again, kind enough to join us, the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Matt McNeil, brand new to you show. John Crippen, the executive director of the Hennepin History Museum, is kind enough to join us. I want to make sure I make a point here. And we talked a lot about restaurants and help out restaurants, talking about the local businesses. Help out the local businesses. But by all means, make sure you take some time, help out those museums out there, because a lot of them, whether it's the art museums, the great top-notch art museums we have in town, you have the science museum, you have history museums, you even have places like the arboretums and the zoos where they are getting hit just as hard as everyone else. So please make sure you try to help out wherever you can. And from your perspective, John, I imagine it's so important to help out your local museums to make sure we still have this vibrant community within Minneapolis, St. Paul that is willing to support the population.
Absolutely. And it is all about just helping each other hunker down and weather the storm. It's been remarkable to me how people have stepped up. And one of our donors just reached out to me early in the pandemic and said, I usually make my gift in August. I'm guessing you could use some cash flow before then, so I'm making my gift early. Others have increased their giving. So I guess I would say to everyone listening, keep doing what you're doing and pick the organizations, pick the things that you value that you want to help keep around. That'll spread around. You can't, everybody can't save everything, but we're all relying on our closest friends to be those friends in need. And I think that's how we're going to make it through.
You do your museum as well. You'd mentioned local heroes. This is the game plan. You are going to, in some capacity, I imagine, open this exhibit coming up here in 2021, right?
That's right. Yeah. So we're focusing on healthcare workers in Hennepin County for a previous era. So we're not going all the way up to the pandemic because, frankly, that story's still being told, and those people are still working hard just to help us through this. But we wanted to, as a way to honor them and highlight that work that's being done right now, we wanted to show, to some extent, the shoulders that they're standing on, the people that built the healthcare system that we are benefiting from today. And there were, as you know, pioneers in the Twin Cities on the healthcare thing. So we'll talk some about the pioneers at the U of M who did the groundbreaking work on transplants and what have you, but also lesser sung heroes, African-American woman who tried to get into nursing school in the 20th century and realized that that was closed to her, so she started doing activism and got the law changed and then got to nursing school so that she could be a nurse for the rest of her life. So lots of, as we're good at doing, bringing out some of those lesser-known stories that inspire people to appreciate what we have today.
You also have an exhibit coming up on 35W, but you're continuing, as you had mentioned, that virtual exhibits are probably not going to be going away. You have some virtual events that are going to be coming up here as well in January, right?
That's right. And 35W, we're going to continue to build towards that exhibit with every month or so we pull out the new research. We don't have the next 35W online thing scheduled, but keep your eye on our website for that. That's a continuation of the owning up work. It's part and parcel with all the things that the George Floyd situation brought to bear for folks. Just understanding how the Twin Cities was built and how that still impacts us today. The 35W story is a fascinating and tragic one as you think about it. Just as a little side note, and then I'll get to the events you asked about. What the researchers over at the U have been finding is, unlike 94, which the story of 94 plowing through the Rondo neighborhood is well known, has been told quite a bit. There was a little less plowing through, although homes were definitely dispossessed, you know, or replaced in 35W. But what they did with 35W was build a barrier, and we found evidence of this in the records, where they wanted, the segregation had happened, the redlining had happened, and they picked the route of 35W to, in effect, harden one of those red lines and say, you people live over here, you people live over there. So it's just part of the same story and part of what we just have to keep bringing to light for folks so we can say, is that how we want to build our community? Let's think about this in a new way. So that's some of the heavy stuff, but really resonating heavy stuff with people. We also try to keep things light and try to give people a break during the pandemic as well. So some of the things that are coming up is we've got our kind of regular offering that has been working well in the pandemic as well is our house history class with Kathy Kohlberg, mm-hmm. Helping people figure out how did my house get here, who lived in it before, helping people do that exploration on their own. And something we happened upon this fall that was really popular, so we're going to do again in January, on January 9th, is a crop art workshop.
Cool.
And initially we didn't think that was really something that would translate to an online, but we figured out how to deliver the supplies to people, and everybody gets on their camera and learns the fascinating art of putting seeds down on paper and making a cool image.
John, I'm going to have to end there. I will drive people to HennepinHistory.org, HennepinHistory.org, for more information about the potential exhibits and the virtual options that they have out there. John Crippen, Executive Director of the Hennepin History Museum, thank you very much. All my best to everyone at the museum. I hope you get through this together, okay?
Thanks so much, Matt. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Once again, full disclosure, I'm on the board there. I do want to make sure I mention that. Thanks for listening to a brand new to you show right here on AM 950.